Hey there, everyone. It's Steve Miller here in Washington. Thank you so much for joining me on Friday, the 27th of May, for VOA's Asia Weekly. Coming up this week on the podcast, we've seen another street killing in Bangladesh this month. Why are these events continuing to take place? Plus, what's the impact on the auto industry after yet another car maker is accused of manipulating environmental data? But first, what are the implications of President Barack Obama's visit to Hiroshima? It was one of the most defining moments in the 20th century and is often referred to as a major factor in what ultimately ended World War II, the dropping of atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. About 140,000 perished in Hiroshima and 70,000 in Nagasaki. About half of those deaths occurred on the day of the blasts, with burns and radiation sickness claiming more in the weeks and months that followed. This weekend, United States President Barack Obama will be the first sitting U.S. president to visit Hiroshima since the devastating weapon was used. The visit has garnered a lot of media attention. After all, this is the site of mass destruction that has been reborn into a peace park, a UNESCO World Heritage Site, and even a tourist destination. But is the media overinflating the significance of the visit?
I believe that the summit is quite historic.
That's Jonathan Miller, East Asia Fellow at the East-West Institute.
President Obama will be the first sitting U.S. president to visit Hiroshima following the bombing. I think it's not as much of a breakthrough when you consider that the U.S. has been slowly building towards this.
And Miller is right. We have seen a number of visits slowly increasing in profile as of late, the most recent with that being of Secretary Kerry at the G7 summit for foreign ministers. So this could be argued that Mr. Obama arriving now is somewhat of a next logical step.
That being said, the president visiting, no question that that's a historic decision. And I think that no matter what Obama says or doesn't say, just the symbolism of him being there is a pretty important and special moment, I think, to some and controversial to others.
But why make this trip now? After all, World War II has been over for 70 years, and the United States and Japan are close allies. Miller explains that it basically came down to public opinion and what a visit to Hiroshima means. Many in the U.S. still feel the use of the bomb helped facilitate the end of a bloody war.
So I think that a visit to Hiroshima by many would be seen as kind of insensitive towards the war veterans, would be seen as something that is the U.S. kind of going back on its decision and kind of revisiting that decision. So I think that lends to some of the controversy on in the United States on the merits of such a visit. And then there's others who see it from a non-proliferation light and believe that such a visit could be seen as a model for Obama's vision on non-proliferation.
Now, with this visit, the issue of whether or not the United States should apologize for use of an atomic weapon once more resurfaced. Speaking to Japanese broadcaster NHK, Mr. Obama responded,
"I think that it's important to recognize that in the midst of war, leaders make all kinds of decisions. It's a job of historians to ask questions and examine them. But I know, as somebody who's now sat in this position for the last 7.5 years, that every leader makes very difficult decisions, particularly during wartime."
Chris Appy is a professor of modern U.S. history at the University of Massachusetts. He spoke to VOA and said he was pleased that the president was going to Hiroshima, but added,
"I am disappointed that the president appears not willing to apologize. After all, I think in our personal lives, we consider it the height of maturity when an adult is willing to take responsibility and accountability for actions, particularly actions that lead to the suffering of innocent victims."
However, when it comes to the issue of an apology, it's relatively easy to sit back and second guess what should or shouldn't happen. But the bottom line is, what do those living in Japan really want? Do the people want an apology? As with most things in life, responses are varied. Some will say yes, and some will say no. But Miller notes,
I think there's a kind of a strategic element there, too, especially with the election happening in the United States. And some in Japan worried that if there's a big push for Obama to make an apology via public address, that that would further mobilize these kind of sort of anti-Japanese rhetoric, which we're seeing a lot from the GOP side now. So I think that there's a fear that they kind of want to fly under the radar a bit. And having Obama just visit alone is a symbolic gesture enough. It's appreciated by the Japanese, but I think they're, my sense, talking to a lot of Japanese insiders on this, is that they're very they're cautious about this visit, too, and they want to distance themselves from it and see it as more of a U.S. initiative rather than something that Japan pushed for.
With all of the focus squarely on President Obama, his visit, and the political ramifications in the United States, not much attention has been placed on what this visit could do for Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Miller believes...
I think it's a great victory for Abe. I mean, I think he's going to be very careful to how much he plays it up. I think he's made the right call by visiting as well. But I think that visiting Hiroshima as well when President Obama will be there. But I think he very much wants to, in some sense, let this be Obama's show. But just by the pure fact that Obama's made that decision, and it's another symbolism of a strengthening U.S.-Japan alliance, it helped make a nice distraction from some of the domestic political things that are going on right now ahead of the upper house elections coming up in the summer. So I think that it's a good timing for Abe for sure. He can use this, to bolster his kind of foreign policy credentials and try to take away from some of the things that are happening right now at home on the economic front.
The East-West Institute's Jonathan Miller also noted that while there may be a small political price to pay for Mr. Obama visiting Hiroshima, he believes the president is addressing items from a more legacy-driven perspective. Many eyes will now turn towards Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and if he will visit Pearl Harbor. That's a trip one Japanese newspaper has reported and something Miller believes would be a natural follow-up to President Obama's Hiroshima visit. But Prime Minister Shinzo Abe says he has no immediate plans to make such a trip. Bangladesh is home to 160 plus million people. It also happens to be home to some of the most horrific murders in Asia. A little over a week ago, a homeopathic doctor was killed when machete-wielding assailants cornered him on motorcycles and hacked him to death. The attack occurred in Kushtia, some 245 kilometers from Dhaka, and happens to be the latest in an increasing series of murders in Bangladesh. But what's happening in Bangladesh that's facilitated a situation where people can, in one instance, barge into a man's home, pull him out into the street, and then hack him to death with a machete right in front of his own family?
There's been an upsurge in Islamist political activity, and a lot of that has turned violent.
That's Jonah Blank, senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation.
It's been a slow process, but really picking up steam over the past few years. And what is particularly worrisome about it is that now ISIS is taking credit for these attacks, and there's even a certain amount of evidence that local ISIS members within Bangladesh are actually starting to organize it.
Tofiq Imroz Khalidi, editor-in-chief at BDNews24.com, says that while the media is paying a lot of attention to things right now, the issue has been festering for quite some time and dates back to Bangladesh's fight for independence in 1971 and the resulting split in society. Jonah Blank doesn't know of any evidence that backs up some claims that the attacks are being perpetrated by Islamic State militants from Syria, but...
What's really dangerous about ISIS, among other things, is that it inspires a lot of copycat killings and a lot of inventive, cruelly, gruesomely inventive types of terrorism that haven't been seen before. So these hacking deaths, this whole series of people hacked with machetes, often in front of their families, this was going on in Bangladesh before ISIS came to prominence. But now we've got this stew of ISIS brutality and of existing brutality that is really making both sides, I think, even more brutal.
So who's being targeted? who needs to be on alert and mindful for their safety.
Unfortunately, everyone is being targeted. The past targets have included not only, in this case, a homeopathic doctor, so their ISIS considers that to be a haram. Lots of bloggers, particularly atheist or secular bloggers. Muslims who don't practice the type of Islam that extremists support. For example, there has been a Sufi leader who's attacked. Shia leaders and clerics have been attacked. Hindus have been attacked. Christians have been attacked.
BDNews24.com's Tawfiq Imroz Khalidi says that some people are concerned about their safety and, well, others aren't. The bottom line, he says, is that life must go on. And that's where attention is placed. It's those who actively write and speak out about social issues that are scared. The RAND Corporation's Jonah Blank says authorities are trying to curtail horrific events.
However, law and order is an uncertain prospect in Bangladesh. Part of the reason that this has been difficult is that at least one of the two major political parties in Bangladesh, the BNP, the Bangladesh National Party, has had a track record of forming political coalitions with some Islamist leaders, not violent ones, but ones that have really pushed the borderline between political expression and outright violence.
Blank says that, unfortunately, hacking deaths are likely to continue.
But the real challenge is that law and order is a very tenuous arrangement in Bangladesh, and the ability to carry out these attacks is almost universal. All it requires is a knife and a deep dark hole in one's heart.
So what can sympathizers do, even outside of Bangladesh? Jonah Blank says,
well, since so many of them actually have been brave advocates for greater political and religious openness, one of the things that all of us can do is read their writings. When a blogger has been killed, we all can go back and try to read that blogger's blog post. That's one way of sending a message. You may be able to kill the messenger, but you can't kill the message.
In September of 2015, the United States Environmental Protection Agency found that many Volkswagen cars in the U.S. had something, well, not quite right with their emissions data. And it wasn't just a few cars either. It was a number shy of just 500,000. At the heart of this controversy was a device that altered emissions tests. In all, about 11 million cars were affected, prompting VW's American head to acknowledge that the company totally screwed up. If that wasn't bad enough, news broke in April that Mitsubishi had been falsifying their fuel efficiency data for 25 years. This month, two more automakers came under scrutiny. Suzuki admitted to improper fuel efficiency testing methods on 16 of its models, a practice that appears to have dated back to 2010. And while the company admitted to no wrongdoing, it did force Mitsubishi president Tatsuro Akaiwa to step down. And just recently, Nissan came under fire in South Korea. The environmental ministry there accused the Japanese automaker of manipulating data on one of its SUVs. In an email statement to VOA, the company said, "Nissan does not manipulate data related to our vehicles. Nissan has not and does not employ illegal defeat or cheat devices in any of the cars we make. Furthermore, following stringent testing and using similar standards to the Korean tests, EU authorities have concluded that Nissan vehicles they tested use no illegal defeat devices. Although the conclusions reached by the Korean authorities are inconsistent with those of other regulators, Nissan will carefully assess and consider appropriate next steps. Nissan is committed to upholding the law and meeting or exceeding regulations in every market where we operate. We are continuing to work with the Korean authorities." So with all of these reports in the news, I had to ask if there really was an uptick in alleged fraudulent activity or if the media was jumping on another bandwagon.
No, it's not just you. This is a huge issue right now, and there's a lot of scandals blowing up around the world.
That's Scott Evans. He's an associate editor at Motor Trend Magazine.
at this point. It's not just the American market either. It's happening in Europe and it's happening in Asia.
So it isn't just me, and there really is an uptick in the number of cases being reported. But then the question turns to why? Why are we seeing so many cases come to light?
The big impetus now is that there's been a scandal and that someone's been caught, not only been caught with the wrong data, but actively cheating. So you've got a whole bunch of boards and executives calling up their engineers and their compliance departments and asking, are we clean? Are we doing things right? Are we doing anything we shouldn't be doing? Because, you know, any good PR person will tell you if you've got, you know, bad news coming, the best thing to do is get out in front of it.
And sure enough, in some cases, that's what's happening. General Motors recently announced incorrect fuel economy data on some of their SUVs. GM announced the error and initiated corrective measures all on their own before the story broke in the press.
But then there's other cases where it's been governments or the press have been digging into these things. And it's all because it all goes back to the Volkswagen scandal. As soon as it was shown that somebody was cheating, everyone from internal compliance departments to government regulators to the press started looking closer and looking for other people who might also be cheating or misstating fuel economy or their emissions.
Diving back into my youth, I used to work in the IT industry. My fellow computer engineers and I would sometimes joke that if the sales force sold it, then we would build it, which really made me wonder if something similar was happening in the auto industry.
Well, it's funny you bring that up because we as the press believe that may be where the Volkswagen scandal started. We don't know for certain yet. The investigations aren't complete. We don't have all the information yet.
Back in 2010 or so, when Volkswagen was developing the diesel engine that was, well, at the heart of this latest scandal, Evan notes,
the company was making a lot of promises about what its diesel technology could do for fuel economy and emissions, only to find out at the last minute that their engineers could not deliver on those promises. And we don't know exactly who came up with the cheating device or when or who approved it, how high it went up in the company. But at some point, we believe that was the impetus for the entire scandal in the first place, was that the company had overpromised and couldn't deliver and had to do something to save face.
He says that these scandals have everyone on their toes and that automakers' internal compliance divisions are going over everything to make sure that there isn't anything out of place. But it's a tricky situation since environmental regulations in one place aren't necessarily the same in another. Beyond that, there are even different rules on how vehicles are tested. Automakers have been pushing for a uniform set of regulations and testing procedures, but as Evan puts it,
well, anytime you involve legislatures around the world, it's going to be hard to find any sort of consensus on what your goals should be and what your requirements should be and what your processes should be.
While the Volkswagen case has generated lawsuits against the company, the bottom line is,
it takes a lot to really damage a brand, especially something as big as an automotive brand. A lot of car shoppers are folks who are not really big into cars. They're not enthusiasts. They're not hobbyists. They use their car as a means of transportation. It gets them from point A to point B, and they need the one that has the best price, gets the best fuel economy, looks the best, and, you know, maybe has the most space for their kids or their dogs or whatever their personal priorities are. And at the end of the day, unless you've got a really tainted brand, people are going to buy the car they want that best suits their lifestyle.
Well, just one quick note before I go. To learn more about how China influences the world and vice versa, you may also like our China 360 podcast. New episodes drop every Monday morning Asian time, and you can grab the link on Twitter at @VOAChina360. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you so much for joining me. Now, if you enjoyed the podcast, please do me a huge favor and share it with your friends and family. I also want to hear from you, so please don't be shy and let me know your thoughts and opinions about the stories this week. To do so, hit me up on Twitter or Facebook. Just look for Steve Miller VOA. And also, be active on our community Facebook page. It's called VOA Now. If you haven't subscribed to the podcast yet, please do. It's quick, it's easy, and best of all, absolutely free. You can subscribe by clicking the link on our program page at voanews.com. Well, thank you so much for joining me this week. In Washington, I'm Steve Miller. And until next time, be true to yourself and always be awesome.